This is Functional Medicine Update for July 2008, Volume 28, Number 7. In this edition, we'll be discussing the progression of cancer. Topics will include xenohormesis, a force for health or disease, cancer, the steps of degeneration, cancer, the steps of prevention, including tumor suppression, endogenous factors and substances, gender-specific genetic risks for cancer, kinesis as cell regulators, and resveratrol, preventing angiogenesis to lower tumor risk. Our interview this month is with Dr. Deborah Davis, discussing cancer research. Now here's Dr. Jeffrey Bland and this edition of Functional Medicine Update.
Welcome to Functional Medicine Update for July 2008. This is going to be a very robust and I hope you'll find informative issue of Functional Medicine Update, in which we're going to be focusing on aspects of environmental carcinogenesis and nutrient relationships to chemo prevention and how these interrelate to topics that we've been exploring so far in the 2008 edition of Functional Medicine Update. And we're very fortunate to have as our clinician/researcher of the month, a person whose name is very familiar to many of us, and that's Dr. Deborah Davis, who is the author of the recent best-selling book, Secret History of the War on Cancer, which I think you'll find to be a fascinating interview and discussion with an opinion leader who holds information and knowledge that most of us aspire to understand and know, and she can help us to get access to that information as we listen to her interview. I want to remind you that the Synthesis by Jeffrey Bland website is now extending and expanding itself. We're doing a blog there, including a video blog, to address some of the questions that come up in between each issue of our taping of Functional Medicine Update, things that might be in the news that people are inquiring about, opinions and positions or analysis of various bits of published data or clinical studies that might have appeared recently. And so you'll find that responses that we're doing on the www.jeffreybland.com website. Also want to remind you that we have, through Synthesis, two new home study product programs that I think you'll find interesting. One is entitled Managing Adrenal and Thyroid Balance Associated with Stress that is recently available. You can find more information about it on the website. And the second is The Emerging Therapeutic Target, Improving Therapeutic Outcomes by Treating the Intersection of Osteoporosis, Cardiovascular Disease, Type 2 Diabetes, Arthritis, and Cancer. So if you want to find out more about either of those new products, you can find that on the www.jeffreybland.com website. So let's move, if we can, into this month's topic, and that is an extension of where we've been evolving our knowledge in 2008 around the concept of xenohormesis, the big X word, xenohormesis. And what this refers to, again, for those of you who maybe are new to this discussion, is the relationship xenophorin. Hormesis refers to a small amount of something having a larger effect than expected, so a foreign substance having a bigger effect on physiological function than expected. And we talk about xenohormetic substances that can either be injurious to physiological function, i.e. distort the web of physiology in such a way as to produce dysfunction that we later call disease, or xenohormetic could be considered things that lead to improved homeodynamic balance or improved stability of the web of physiology and increase the resistance to environmental perturbation, i.e. enhance organ reserve. So the term xenohormesis doesn't imply a value term as it relates to good or bad. It implies an effect on physiology greater than that which you would anticipate based upon the amount of material, and xeno refers to foreign, meaning coming from the outside environment. So this could come from something like a petrochemical polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbon, which would be a xenohormetic response. It probably would be injurious to the web of physiology. Or it could be a molecule that's come up through natural selection through a diet, like a flavonoid, an isoflavone, a polyphenol, a proanthocyanidin, that may have a positive impact on improving physiological function or stability of the web of physiology. And there's a very interesting review paper that was just authored by Conrad Howitz and David Sinclair from Harvard University entitled Xenohormesis, Sensing the Chemical Cues of Other Species. And this appeared in the journal Cell, Volume 133, page 387 in 2008. And they talk about the fact that plants make substances of benefit to human health, as we know. And actually, one-third of the current top 20 drugs in the market are plant-derived and have been modified to make them new to nature so that they can be patented. But the ultimate pharmacophore that these drugs were built upon were molecules that were evolved in nature over natural selection processes that gave rise to interaction with human physiology in such a way as to have a xenohormetic effect, meaning modulate complex network physiological function. And of course, we know probably the most well-discussed of these has to do with Edward Stone's testing the bark of the white willow, Salix alba, for treating fever and concluded that it was very efficacious. And aspirin today, of course, is the most common drug of choice in the world at large for the management of many, many different maladies. And in fact, it's interesting that the first drug that was derived from natural product that's been used commercially now for a couple of centuries has really turned out to be one of the most efficacious and probably, when used appropriately, safe. So we started off on the right foot, I guess, in appropriating some of these things from nature as it relates to a purified material that was later appropriated into pharmacology as acetyl salicylic acid, which was the chemically modified derivative of the aspirin molecule or the aspirin pharmacophore found in the plant. In fact, there are 45,000 metric tons of acetylated derivatives of salicylic acid that are now consumed worldwide each year, which makes it a pretty remarkable compound. But beyond that, as you probably know, that there is this view that these molecules that are found in plants can have direct modulation of key mammalian intracellular signal transduction processes, i.e. the processes by which our physiology is regulated. So they're xenohormetic in the way of enhancing the body's response to stress. So we might think of molecules like curcumin from the spice turmeric, or we think of something like epigallocatechin gallate that's found in green tea as a polyphenolic material. Or we think of, in red wines and peanut skins, something like resveratrol that modulates then various aspects of cell signaling through kinase modulation, protein kinase C delta or gamma, or phosphatidyl inositol 3 kinase, or looking at its effect on SYK or BTK, the Burton tyrosine kinase. We're starting to recognize at the mechanistic level how these xenohormetic substances in foods have interfaced and interrelated with the symphonic orchestration of our physiology. The expression of genes into function occurs through the interaction with these complex molecules that we eat in a diet with variety and color and close to the earth, i.e. these phytochemicals, by the very nature of PHYTO chemicals, are derived from plants. So it's these minimally processed plant-derived foods that give rise to these xenohormetic substances. And we've heard a number of extraordinary contributors to this field over the last few months on Functional Medicine Update discuss the evolution of this model, the advancing of this whole conceptual framework of how a complex diet and these molecules interface with function. So these are secondary metabolites of plants that plants make as their own anti-stress molecules, flavonoids, the carotenoids, the xanthophylls, and these particular molecules then serve the plant to defend itself against environmental stresses, insects, sunburn, parasites, infection. And then when we consume those plants that contain these complex phytochemicals, they then have influence on our function through these intracellular signal transduction processes in such a way as to modulate our network physiology and to increase stress resistance. We call these antioxidants often, but they're much more than antioxidants. Antioxidants is kind of a general term that refers to the ability to quench free radical oxidation processes. But well below that, mechanistically, what we're starting to see is that these specific phytochemicals have very distinct and unique abilities based upon the plant source and the individual shape of the molecules to influence signal transduction at the mitochondrial level, at the cell cytosolic level, or even at the genomic expression level, so that it influences the trilogy of omics, the genomics, proteomics, and metabolomics of the organism, and ultimately then its phenomics, how it looks, acts, and feels. So a much bigger role that nutrition is being seen to play on physiological function. And by the opposite token, you can imagine xenohormetic substances that were new to nature, that were synthetically modulated ingredients within our foods, like partially hydrogenated transoid-containing fats that have a different role to play on hormesis, and small amounts of them may have a more dramatic effect on distorting the web and producing alarm reactions, such things as inflammatory modulation in specific tissue. So, as I mentioned earlier, the term xenohormesis doesn't necessarily mean either good nor bad influence on physiology. What it means is that each of these molecules, small in amount, may have a bigger effect on regulatory nodes of physiology than we would have anticipated, and it could be a stabilizing influence or it could be a destabilizing influence. Now, how does this all relate to cancer? Because that's the topic of this month's discussion. So if you think of the cancer process as it's emerged to be seen over the last 30 years, it's recognized to go through a series of steps that start with initiation. Sometimes this is called mutagenesis or carcinogenesis, so the tumor initiation process. Then it goes through a series of cellular alterations of function that lead to propagation with cell replication in a dedifferentiated state, a juvenile embryonic-like state, rapidly dividing in a dedifferentiated state. And then from there, it goes into a state of having to feed itself, the process of angiogenesis. And once you get beyond about a 3-millimeter tumor mass, it has to have its own blood supply for fixed tumors or solid tumors. So that then requires a blood supply, and it does this angiogenic process. And then obviously the last step and the most lethal part of cancer is its tendency then to break off certain cells and find sites of infiltration in other tissues that we call metastasis. And this metastatic process is what often then is the lethal event associated with cancer. If we look then at these particular processes, initiation, propagation, angiogenesis, and metastasis, each one of those has regulatory control systems associated with it. And therefore, one might say that cancer is a complex process of the interaction of the genes with the environment, the whole organism with their environment, that leads to these things that we see clinically of dedifferentiated proliferative metastatic cell lines, which then ultimately start taking over and alter the energy economy of the host, in which the host ultimately has the potential for a lethal event that caused by starvation and by complete alteration of immunological function. So with all of that as a context, we might then say, how does chemo prevention really work in trying to prevent cancer at various stages, either at the initiation stage, at the propagation stage, at the angiogenic stage, or at the metastatic stage? Clearly, the earlier that one can engage in prevention, the better off one is. If you can prevent initiation, you don't have to worry about propagation, angiogenesis, and metastatic events. But obviously, there must be regulatory control steps at each of those steps in the process. And so if it were to be that a tumor is already initiated, a cell is already initiated into a dedifferentiated state, an oncogenic state, then you want to regulate the propagation, the angiogenic, and the metastatic processes so that that cell type will starve or be attacked by the immune system in such a way that it will never go to the next stage of development. And part of this relationship of how these things get started has to do not only with that which relates to mutations of the genes as a consequence of injury by a chemical or radiation event, but also by epigenetic effects that are those which, as we have learned earlier in Functional Medicine Update, mask and silence certain genes or upregulate the expression of other genes. So you'd like to, in theory, silence your oncogenes, and you'd like to upregulate the expression of your tumor suppressor genes. So that would sound like a way of putting bookmarks on the sections of your book of life that had to do with your oncogenes and say, do not read, X-rated. And then you'd like to put sticky notes on the sections of your book of life, the chapters in your genes that are associated with tumor suppressor gene activity and natural killer cell activity and so forth. So you'd like this regulatory balance of gene expression at the epigenetic level. And as we know, there are sticky notes and paper clips that are put on in part as a consequence of nutritional status. For instance, we know the paper clips or the gene silencers are related in part to methylation of the promoter regions of specific genes. And the methyl groups come by way of what? Well, we've learned, all of us at some length, that that comes through the folate cycle, through S-adenosylmethionine. And so you start to say, well, does elevated homocysteine have anything to do with a carcinogenic risk and the increased potential for initiation of a tumor when exposed to a carcinogen? And the answer is yes. Animal studies have demonstrated that, that under-methylated promoter regions of oncogenes increases carcinogenic risk. So that's why folate, B12, B6, and betaine become very important nutrients for modulating the gene silencing influence on oncogenes, and why it is known that animals that are in a malnourished environment have a higher carcinogen risk as it relates to procarcinogenesis, because of the fact that their oncogenes are not as silenced. Their promoter regions are available. So that's one concept. The other concept would be, what about the activation of your tumor suppressor genes? And you want to put the read here, sticky notes on the promoter regions of those genes. And as you probably know, one of the groups that causes read here are your acetyl groups. Acetylation of the histone and non-histone proteins as well as the promoter regions leads to an unfolding of the supercoiled structure of the genome so that it can be accessed then to read that specific chapters in your book of life. Acetyl groups are put on there as a consequence of available acetyl-CoA. So you start talking about, well, you have to have proper bioenergetics. You have to have the proper Krebs cycle activity, mitochondrial bioenergetics, because if you're malnourished and you have poor mitochondrial function, you're acetyl-CoA deprived, and you don't have your acetyl groups to be put on as readme sticky notes onto the histone proteins or onto your genome. We also know that butyrate, a very interesting small molecule, 4-carbon fatty acid or short-chain fatty acid molecule, which is produced by gut fermentation by bacteria fibers, also has a very important role to play in regulating the readme messages on specific regions of your genome that are associated with tumor suppression. So we recognize that proper in situ production of butyrate by gut fermentation by bacteria of non-digestible fibers, or sometimes called prebiotics, is very important as a colon cancer chemo preventive. So we've started to understand the mechanism of protection of a fiber-rich meal on colon carcinogenesis. So I think that these concepts are not just academic. The initiation, propagation, angiogenesis, and metastatic steps are not just academic. We're starting to see how they actually translate into therapeutic potentials for prevention of cancer. So we're really talking here, aren't we, about the molecular origins of cancer. And there is actually a very nice editorial written on this in the New England Journal of Medicine, volume 358, page 527 in 2008, talking about that over the last decade, insights into the origin and behavior of cancers have reshaped our understanding. The seminal feature of all of this research seems to be the focus on how the steps of initiation, propagation, angiogenesis, and metastases can be modulated at the cellular level, so that it then takes us back to recognizing that maybe the most important thing we've learned since President Nixon started the, quote, war on cancer was not necessarily how to treat cancer, but how better to prevent it based upon accessing the appropriate information to prevent initiation, propagation, angiogenesis, and metastasis. And then we're starting to learn that cancer obviously is cancers. It's plural because these mutated cells are different from person to person. We have our own individual cancer that's part of the family of cancers. And so each mutated cell, which may be a mutated kinase or a mutated intercellular signal transduction agent, plays out its personality slightly differently than other cancers. And that's why no two patients are exactly the same when treated even with the same chemotherapeutic drug or cancer therapy. So it's a very, very interesting evolving field. It's almost like studying ecology with a diversity of species in the environment. When we start talking about cancer, each one having a unique personality. Now we're starting to see these cancer cell types being genotyped with gene arrays, and then specific types of molecules being used to arrest the mutated kinases in that specific tumor. This is drugs like Gleevec, for instance, that are kinase inhibiting drugs. It's a different approach towards modulating in therapy cancer. But if we back well before the need for therapy to the chemo prevention stage, we can see that many of these constructs that we're starting to understand as it relates to the origin of cancer help us to better understand how to design preventive and early stage intervention approaches that are built on this initiation and propagation series of steps. So with all of that as the context, then, we might say, what about such things that are endogenous to the human body that might be associated with cancer initiation? Now, we think of exogenous substances like pollutants, and we're going to hear from Dr. Deborah Davis today in greater detail about the role that the environment plays in inducing the potential initiation and even propagation of cancer as a consequence of exposure to new foreign molecules. But what about endogenous substances? And I'm thinking of molecules as an example, like sex steroid hormones. So the one that has probably received the most attention is estrogens and the estrogenic metabolites, which are the hydroxylated estrogens and their quinone byproducts. As you've heard in the past from an eloquent interview with Dr. Eleanor Rogan from the University of Nebraska, we're now starting to recognize that initiation of cancer can result from endogenous injury caused by chemicals that are present in the normal physiology that undergo chemical transformation, like odd oxidation to form, in the case of estrogen, 17-beta-estradiol can be hydroxylated to the 4-hydroxyestrogen by cytochrome P451B1, which then in turn can be odd oxidized to the 3,4-quinone. And this 3,4-quinone derivative of estradiol, as we have learned from Dr. Rogan's work, is extraordinarily electrophilic, meaning it seeks out an electron-dense region of the book of life, the DNA, and it chemically reacts with these electron-rich regions in our DNA molecules to produce these covalently bound apurinic bases, which then can avoid excision types of repair mechanisms and induce then frameshift mutations and induce then potential carcinogenesis. So here is a case where an endogenous molecule, 17-beta-estradiol, undergoing an unusual type of physiological transformation process to form the 3,4-quinones, in the absence of proper protection, can then induce potential carcinogenesis in estrogen-sensitive tissues, which could be the breast, the endometrium, ovary. And so we start asking the question, how does the body protect itself against this biotransformation process that leads to potential endogenous carcinogenesis? And Dr. Rogan and other people's work has identified the fact that there are many steps that help to protect against that. The body's just not laid naked to the exposure to the 3,4-quinones, that there is glutathione conjugation that's possible at the previous step prior to the intercalation step, where you get the reaction of the 3,4-quinone with DNA. So glutathione protection, we know that antioxidation states of that tissue plays a very important role in keeping the semi-quinone from oxidizing into the full 3,4-quinone. So redox potential of the cells or antioxidants are important. And thereby we go back and ask, what types of phytochemicals can find themselves concentrated in these tissues where these reactions are ongoing? Because there are different partition coefficients of different phytochemicals, and there are different transport mechanisms. They don't appear in the same concentrations of all tissues. They have certain tissue affinities. So we might start saying it's not just antioxidants in general, it's the tissue-specific effects of certain phytochemicals that help modulate the conversion of a semi-quinone into a 3,4-estrogen quinone that can then be injurious. And you'll notice I'm going to a higher level of questioning about how we actually develop a science-based chemo prevention program. What would we harness in the way of specific nutrients for the prevention, say, of prostate cancer or breast cancer, based on what we're learning about these mechanisms? Because the story I've just talked about with breast cancer and 3,4-quinones of estrogen also applies to prostate cancer in males, where estrogen is also produced in the prostate gland and can undergo oxidation to the 3,4-quinones, as we learned from Dr. Rogan, and can induce initiation of prostate cancer. So here is where sisters and brothers may have similar genes relative to risk, and it plays out in different ways, in their gender-specific ways, in the breast in the sister and in the prostate in the brother. And as you know, these are interesting epidemiological connections. Sisters who have breast cancer have a higher statistical increase in the brothers who have prostate cancer. So here's where mechanism and epidemiology tend to converge. So we start asking questions, what are some of the kinds of phytochemicals that have been found to have xenohormetic effects of a positive nature in helping to reduce those events? And we talk about things like epigallocatechin gallate or green tea. We talk about limonene, which is, as you know, a monoterpene that's derived from citrus. We talk about areas that relate to curcumin, but one asks, is it curcumin directly because it's relatively bioavailable, or is it subtle effects that curcumin has on the immunological system that communicates to the breast and prostate? These are still questions that are being asked, because we often assume that if there's an epidemiological connection between a phytochemical and a reduced incidence of cancer, that the role of that phytochemical must be directly on that tissue. But now we're starting to see that maybe these things can also work indirectly through alterations in specific immunological functions. So maybe the functional change occurs at the gastrointestinal mucosa by interaction of a bioavailable flavonoid, but it influences at a receptor site in the GI tract a signaling mechanism that then communicates ultimately to tissues at a distance. So you'll notice that this is a systems biology approach I'm talking about here that relates to chemo prevention. It's not so simple as just a single molecule and a single endpoint type of analysis. So this mechanism of oncogenic cooperation and cancer initiation is what I've really been speaking to. And there's a very nice review paper on this whole concept that appeared in the Yale Journal of Biological Medicine, volume 79, page 95, in 2006, that starts to look at cancer as this disease of extreme heterogeneity and how there are general principles that no matter the specific of the gene characteristic of the cancer, that we can then employ to try to prevent this initiation process or to lower the oncogenic potential. And that becomes the science, the new science, I believe, of nutrition and chemo prevention. So if we look at a simplified version of this whole discussion of cancer initiation and progression, there is a very nice kind of review paper that I found very intriguing in Theoretical Biology and Medical Modeling, Volume 3, page 37 in 2006, that really talks about cancer initiation and its progression, and really starts having us view this relationship between the host immune system, their gastrointestinal function, their biotransformational systems and how they can detoxify substances, and their genetic susceptibility or sensitivity based upon epigenetic and genetic loci of sensitivity gives rise to that person's own individual risk to cancer based upon exposure to a substance. So that's why this field is so complicated, because you can't just take a individual molecule and say it has a certain toxicity or a certain carcinogenic potential that is going to be equal in all people to which it's exposed. Witness, if you would, cigarette smoking as probably the classic example. We know that there are 3-pack-per-day smokers that don't get lung cancer, and yet there are people who are exposed to but a much smaller level of secondary smoke who do get lung cancer, and it has to do, again, with these multiple factors interacting. I'm not even talking here about covariables, because we don't just get exposed to one thing at a time. We get exposed to all sorts of things simultaneously that has this symphonic orchestration. But with all of that in mind, there is still a unifying mechanism by which we might think about preventing tumor initiation based upon the integrity of our epigenome and our genome, and preventing genomic instability. And again, I come back to the wonderful discussion we had with Dr. Michael Finnick about this morphological marker for biological aging and risk to age-related diseases, this genomic instability argument. And in fact, Ercole Cavalieri and Eleanor Rogan authored a very nice paper entitled A Unifying Mechanism in the Initiation of Cancer and Other Diseases that appeared in the Annals of New York Academy of Sciences in 2004, volume 1028, page 247, in which they talked about the fact that by offering that individual the exposure to the right mosaic of chemopreventive agents, that it helps to defend against these initiating processes that lead to dedifferentiated cell replication that we call oncogenesis. So I think that we're starting to witness the emergence of a science base for cancer chemo prevention. You'll notice that I have spoken at several stages along this discussion about a class of enzymes that are involved with this intracellular signal transduction process, meaning taking information from outside cells and communicating it to inside cells. And these enzymes, whose name you're now fairly familiar with, are called kinases. And kinases are a family of over 500 different enzymes whose role it is to selectively phosphorylate or put a phosphate group at a specific region on a macromolecule. And these kinases are cell regulators in terms of function. They're kinases that work within the genome itself. They're kinases that work by modulating the epigenome. They're kinases that work in the cytosol to modulate post-translationally the function of proteins and enzymes. And then there are kinases that work within mitochondria that modulate the bioenergetics of the cell. So these kinases have very important roles to play in transducing signals from the outside world, meaning outside the cell, inside to the regulatory regions of the cell where function ultimately exists. And I've talked about acetylation of the genome that leads to read-me-here type messages. I talked about methylation that leads to gene silencing, like putting paperclips on certain chapters in your book of life. And I also want to make sure you understand that these kinases that phosphorylate in various regions of the genome and the histone proteins and ultimately also post-translationally modify active proteins within the cytosol of the cell, these are also very important regulators of the phenotype of the cell, its function. Now, you might say, well, how does that have anything to do with carcinogenesis and tumor initiation or propagation? Because the dysregulation of kinases or the mutation of kinases has been in the last 10 years identified to be very closely associated with the process of cancer initiation and propagation. So regulation of kinase signaling is a very important role in chemo prevention. Now, why am I going into great detail on this? Because the work that we and many others have been doing over the past several years has identified that one of the roles that phytochemicals has in modulating cellular function is their role on kinases, on specific kinases. And Mother Nature has produced a whole array of natural molecules in these complex diets that we consume that have specificity for how they modulate specific kinases. So when we're eating foods, a variety and a rich array of unprocessed ingredients, phytochemicals, we're eating a complex library of kinase modulating substances that help to regulate the network of our physiology, the transduction of outside messages to inside cellular function. And I think that that's an important thing to keep in mind as it relates to how we think about nutrients, because often we see studies being done in chemo prevention using one nutrient at a time, where we use a vitamin E or a beta carotene or a vitamin C, one nutrient at a time, and then we ask, what is its outcome as a drug-like intervention in protection against a certain disease or event? And actually, that's not how the signature of our dietary information influences function in the broader sense. It's not a drug-like effect. It's a systems biology effect by this complex orchestration across families of interrelated kinases that then regulate genomic expression, that regulate intracellular signal transduction, and ultimately even bioenergetics at the mitochondrial level. Now, this may appear way overly technical for you as you sit there with a patient and ask, well, what do I do? But the reason I'm trying to make this a driving point is that the evidence that has accumulated the last few years from clinical, animal, and basic science research is that these rich arrays of complex matrices of nutrients appears to have a different effect on physiological outcome than taking one nutrient at a time, or so-called mega nutrition, looking at a more pharmacological approach of each nutrient at a time. So if we ask the question about resveratrol, let's use that, it's been in the news quite a bit. We know that resveratrol is associated with chemo prevention of breast cancer from animal models. And we say, well, then is giving resveratrol at high dose an approach towards chemo prevention that would be justifiable? Obviously, that's a pharmacological model, but you might ask the question, well, what about lower doses of resveratrol in the combination with the multiple other phytochemicals that are found within, say, peanut skins, or that are found within grapes, or found within foods that are rich in resveratrol? Does that have a different orchestration of effects when combined as a mixture than when you're using a single molecule in purified dose. And it appears, once again, that what is emerging is these signatures of complex mixtures that influence intercellular signal transduction and the cancer initiation process have a different effect. So again, coming back to eating variety, eating color, and using families of phytochemicals. Now, Dr. Randy Jertl, who is the Department of Radiation Oncology University Program in Genetics and Genomics at Duke University, who is one of the fathers of the epigenetics field, has recently published with his group a very interesting paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, where they showed that maternal nutrient supplementation of animals that had been exposed to a known carcinogen, bisphenol A, this is the plasticizer that's been of some concern in plastic bottles, you know, as it relates to potential carcinogenesis. So when these animals are exposed to bisphenol A, it results in carcinogenesis. And when they supplemented these animals with specific nutrients that were involved with silencing oncogenes, and that would be your methylating nutrients, they were able to basically show that there was compelling evidence that early developmental exposure to certain nutrients can help to neutralize the effect of later exposure to these carcinogens, or that early exposure to carcinogens in the absence of proper nutrient intake can imprint the genome to make it more susceptible in later life to carcinogens. So it works both ways. Poor nutrient intake imprints the gene in such a way as to make it more susceptible over life to cancer. Proper nutrition during pregnancy then silences the genes and makes up to the animal less susceptible throughout life to exposure to carcinogens. So you might ask the question, are we doing both things simultaneously in our culture? Are we reducing the level of intake of specific nutrients that are necessary to protect against genetic expression that we associate with cancer, while we're also increasing the exposure to carcinogens? And of course, this was the theme that Dr. Bruce Ames, in his landmark article and discussion on Science Magazine many years ago called Dietary Carcinogens and Anticarcinogens, was talking about, saying that it seems that we're reducing our anti-carcinogenic intake in our diet while we're increasing carcinogenic exposure. So this, I think, is a very important construct. And then it leads us into saying, well, let's assume that you initiated a tumor and it started to propagate and it needed to undergo angiogenesis in order to feed itself. Are there natural anti-angiogenic substances? And of course, the answer is yes. Dr. Judah Folkman just recently passed away, the father of angiogenesis, and what a sad loss that was to the science and medical community. As you probably recognize, he had been working extraordinarily hard over many years in trying to help the world understand the importance of angiogenesis and anti-angiogenesis in tumor prevention and tumor treatment. We now recognize this angiogenic process of formation of blood supply to feed a tumor, that there are many nutrients that have phytochemicals that have been found to be anti-angiogenic. In fact, it's interesting, we just found recently in some work we were doing that derivatives from the Humulus lupulus plant, the hops plant, had a very strong anti-angiogenic properties, meaning they, in tumor cell explant models, were able to actually prohibit the development of the blood supplies necessary to feed the tumors. So there is a tremendous amount of work now ongoing as it relates to the role that various phytochemicals have, even after initiation has been established, to prevent angiogenesis and to hopefully starve the tumor and make it more susceptible then to the body's immune system. And then, of course, lastly is anti-metastatic agents and the things that are hopeful in being able to prevent metastatic transformation of the tumor, which, as we said earlier, is one of the major concerns that one has in cancer, is the metastatic event that leads to seeding in other parts of the body. So this concept that we heard Dr. Mukhtar talk about, Dr. Hassan Mukhtar, who was talking about cancer chemo prevention through dietary phytochemicals, we're starting to witness the emergence of this field, I think, around the major cancers to which the nutrients appear to have a very important role: colon cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, as being right at the head of the list of those that seem to be very sensitive to nutrient modulation, both at the prevention and maybe even the early stage intervention levels. So when we start looking at things like Spes PC and years ago, the complex array of phytochemicals in Chinese herbs that help in prostate cancer, we go back in the lens of today and we say maybe there are things in these complex mixtures that really do influence the processes of initiation, propagation, angiogenesis, and metastasis that frame a new way of approaching chemo prevention from a mechanistic approach. So with that in mind, let's turn it over to our clinician of the month. Well, once again, we're here at that part of Functional Medicine Update that I know you, as well as I, really look forward to, and we won't be disappointed this issue. We have a real treat in store, someone whose work I've followed for many years, and I'm very privileged to have the chance to interview her, Dr. Devra Lee Davis, who the name goes without even further explanation, author of a recent book, The Secret History of the War on Cancer, but before that, the best-selling book, When Smoke Ran Like Water. Probably recognize she has a series of extraordinary honors in her background, including being appointed by President Clinton to the Chemical Safety and Hazard Investigation Board. She's a BS in Physiological Psychology with an MA in Sociology from the University of Pittsburgh, completed her PhD in Science Studies at the University of Chicago as a Danforth Foundation Graduate Fellow. She has an MPH in Epidemiology. She's taken a lot of tests in her life, I can tell that. She's authored over more than 170 publications in books and journals, and her article in Scientific American on carcinogenicity and estrogen relationships was one of the foundations for my thinking. She's a member of the American College of Toxicology and Epidemiology and a visiting professor of the Department of Environmental and Occupational Medicine at Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York, and on and on and on. So I won't belabor this other than saying we have a very credentialed and capable person who is going to speak to us on a topic that for me started when I first met Rachel Carson many years ago and was very heavily impacted with her Silent Spring book. And then later, as you probably know, we interviewed for a Functional Medicine Update, Dr. Sandra Steingraber, with her what I thought was an absolutely fantastic book, Living Downstream. It's interesting that it seems that women scientists are more interested in this topic than men, because you notice the third name, Dr. Devra Lee Davis, is also a female with great scientific credentials in this field. Maybe that's their stewardship of the environment and a sense of mothering the world. I'm not sure, but it seems like we have all the great thinkers that have come through the female gender. So, Dr. Davis, it's really a pleasure to have you today and as an expert on this topic. And I think the first question I'd like to ask you that comes out of your extraordinary book is that we started down this road on Nixon's war on cancer. It doesn't appear as if the outcome of that war was maybe much different than other wars. It just continues on at a level of conflagration, but we have learned quite a bit, it seems, and you've pointed this out beautifully in your book on the area of chemo prevention, maybe more than actual treatment. And this history seems to start somewhere back, according to your book, in Germany with this bifurcation of thinking between the chemical industry and organic food. Could you tell us a little bit about how you got into this and how this all might fit together?
I was astonished to learn that actually under the Nazis there was a serious program to try to prevent smoking and reduce occupational carcinogens. And at the same time, the site of the world's first organic gardens was at Dachau, where they were growing organic honey and trying to encourage young Aryan women not to eat any refined flours and sugars. It was an astonishing thing to learn, and it was part of their overall program of racial hygiene, the notion being that they would weed out defectives and produce a healthier breed of humans by not allowing German women to smoke or to eat bad food.
And this is at the same time where we saw the development of the chemical dye industry and the start of what was later to be the modern pharmaceutical industry. It's kind of an interesting paradox.
It is indeed. Germany was not united in many ways, although one thing that's kind of chilling to realize is that doctors were among the earliest and most ardent supporters of Hitler and of the idea that you could selectively decide who was fit to reproduce. And so they had programs first sterilizing and later killing people that they judged to be defective. And of course, among the most defective were the political dissidents, the Jews, the Catholic priests who didn't agree with them. All of them were among those who were judged unfit to reproduce.
And it's interesting, you point out something I'd never really thought about, and that's the origin of the discipline of epidemiology, which allows us to see some of these associations in large population groups between an agent and an outcome. So tell us a little bit about how epidemiology grew out of the soil.
Well, there were some very astute scientists in Germany. In fact, until the early 1930s, Germany had won the most Nobel Prizes, and it was the language of science was German. And among the excellent German scientists were people who began to look at patterns in time and space that disease created. They did the first epidemiology showing that tobacco clearly caused lung cancer, but they also observed workers and found that if workers produced certain synthetic dyes, 100% of them would develop bladder cancer in 20 years. And they had a treasure trove of information, much of which has been ignored by the West, not just because of its questionable origins, but also because immediately after the war, American and British scientists went over and captured the records and the German scientists who had done this work and gathered that information for the Office of Secret Service and the British counterpart as well, but did not share it broadly with the governments or with the workers who were affected.
So there's a long-standing, almost social history, it appears from historical records, of lack of full disclosure and this concept that maybe it's best that the public doesn't know, we'll just hold this information in trust, which leads to the ability to manipulate, it sounds like.
I think that's right. I mean, after all, war crimes are what the losers get charged with. And right after World War II broke out, American companies actually gave the formula to make leaded gasoline to the Germans, the Japanese, and the Italians. Without that formula, they would not have been able to fight against American GIs. And right after the war ended, Robert Kehoe, the medical director of the Ethel Corporation, went over to Germany and collected information on what they knew about bladder cancer and the role of synthetic dyes, diethyl stibesterol, and other things that we now understand were signals of industrial hazard.
It seems fascinating to me because I remember studying back years ago when I took an epidemiology course that Percival Pott, working with the record of chimney sweeps, had come to the conclusion that testicular cancer had something to do with exposure to coal tar dye in chimneys. So it seems like that preceded all of this, and yet it's taken these many years to uncover all of this.
Well, actually, I was astonished to learn that in 1936, shortly before World War II broke out, the world's leading cancer scientists traveled to Brussels and agreed at that time that based on what was then known, coal tars, like those who lodge in the scrotum, coal tars were a cause of cancer, scrotal cancer, in chimney sweeps. They understood that cobalt and uranium mining caused cancer in workers. They knew that X-rays, solar radiation caused cancer, and if you painted hydrocarbons on the skin of animals and gave them solar radiation, you could magnify the response. So what was considered evidence of cancer in the 1930s was a combination of animal experiments and some human evidence. And what happened after the war was that epidemiology as a discipline became interpreted as the requirement before we could say something was causal. And the effect of that was to make it necessary to wait till we had enough proof of human harm in the form of dead or sick workers, or in the case of tobacco, people who clearly had been smoking for a long time. And what that meant, because cancer has such a long latency, as you know, is that we were dooming one generation to be experimental subjects in order to decide whether we could try to protect a future generation. That is precisely what we did with tobacco epidemiology, so that not until the 1990s was government action started against tobacco. And when the war on cancer gets launched by President Nixon in 1971, it's completely silent about tobacco, although the hazards of tobacco were known in the scientific community in the 1930s and 1940s.
Yeah, you make such a really remarkable point in your book of helping us to understand that this understanding of the correlation or the association between smoking and lung cancer was brought really from Germany with some of the post-war intelligentsia that we inherited after the war and actually became kind of the seed of the anti-smoking research here in the United States, although obviously not heavily embraced by the tobacco industry.
Right.
So as we look, in fact, who was the gentleman I think you spoke of that was one of the most charismatic people that carried the banner that set up the American Health Foundation research in Valhalla,
well,
New York?
Ernie Van Winder was quite an interesting guy. He had been a young man in Germany, and he also was in the Secret Service and went over right after the war to collect information on what the Germans knew. And while he did that, and quite likely learned about their own research on tobacco and lung cancer, he never mentioned it in his own work. And in 1950, with a famous surgeon, he published work showing that people with lung cancer had been smokers. And his work and that of Dahl and Hill appeared in 1950 in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
Yeah, and I think it's another, it burst one of my bubbles when I read about Sir Richard Dahl and what I thought was his extraordinary contributions to the birthing of modern epidemiology. And yet it looks like so many of those people were serving also with joint appointments as consultants to the tobacco industry. So some of the work in terms of the interpretation wasn't maybe as clean as we might have liked it to be.
Well, you know, it was very saddening for me to find that Richard Dahl, who's been a hero of so many of us, had secretly accepted money from the asbestos industry, from the vinyl chloride industry, and from others throughout his career and didn't disclose that funding. So he would publish findings that were quite friendly to the industry without indicating that they were supporting his work. And we'll never really know whether the funding had any influence on the positions that he took, because think about it, if he hadn't cooperated with the asbestos industry, we would not have any data at all on asbestos.
Yes.
And that is the challenge for modern epidemiology as well. We have to have cooperation with industry to get information, and yet because the pendulum has swung so heavily in favor of protecting trade secrets, those trade secrets that a company maintains may have cost my father his life. And it's perfectly legal to keep information secret, but sometimes what's legal can be immoral. Slavery was legal. Apartheid was legal. But obviously today we think those things were immoral. And it was legal for Richard Dahl to collect large sums of money from the chemical industry and not disclose it when he published articles saying that vinyl chloride was not as big a danger as the World Health Organization itself had said just a few years earlier. And because it was Richard Dahl, a man revered by many of us in public health research, when he reached that conclusion, people accepted it.
So that then, going to a more recent time, I know you know even better than I about the vitriol that was written in the New England Journal of Medicine in review of Living Downstream, Steingraber's book, and it turned out on disclosure. And in fact, I'm very pleased to say that the person who seemed to be the first whistleblower on the fact that the reviewer for her book in the New England Journal of Medicine was the toxicologist for the Grace Chemical Company that he didn't disclose, that the first person to point that out was one of my friends, a medical doctor in Southern Oregon, that wrote a letter to the editor and finally exposed that that had been the case. And I think they said they had changed their policy now as it relates to disclosure for reviewers. But
right.
It seems like there's a history here of this happening.
Yes, there certainly is. And I think that's where our democracy, as imperfect as it is, that's where programs like yours play a very valuable function, because we're able to get information out. Steingraber's book is a brilliant, brave, bold, and important book. And it was very unfairly reviewed in the New England Journal of Medicine by someone who worked for the Grace Company, the company that was responsible for massive pollution in an area of Massachusetts called Woburn, where there was so much pollution and so much illness that the people affected actually recovered for their damages. That's an unusual situation. Most often when people are harmed by toxic materials, it's close to impossible to prove in a court of law what the causes of their harm was, and it's becoming more and more difficult to do so. As I discuss in my book, The Secret History of the War on Cancer, the courts have increasingly made it very difficult for people who've been harmed by toxic substances to recover at all.
So that leads me, obviously, then to your book and you as an author and you as an expert in the field. Obviously, you've also engendered the wrath of those who don't want this information to be fully disclosed. Tell us a little about your history.
Well, I'm still standing, but there's no question that there have been some unfair hits on my book. One appeared in the New Republic, much to my surprise, where the reviewer actually used material from my book without acknowledging it had come from my book, and accused me of being unscientific when I talked about the role of spiritual matters in helping people to heal. And when I talked about my views that complementary and integrative medicine are very powerful tools that we do not fully understand, that can often play a remarkable role in helping people recover and do well. When I discussed my friend Les Thiel, who's an extraordinary 7-year ovarian cancer survivor of stage 3B ovarian cancer, and the work that she did, the efforts of Donna Karen to promote yoga for cancer patients, All of these things, as you know very well, are fundamentally changing the nature of cancer care and the way we think about illness today. And yet this reviewer thought that all of that was just terribly unscientific.
So you've known and touched upon in your book a variety of very strong personalities who have also been similarly painted in a certain brush. That's people like Sam Epstein, who I've had the chance to meet, or Irving Selikoff with asbestosis. What's been your discussions with these as colleagues in this area?
Well, I mean, we all owe Sam Epstein an enormous debt of gratitude. In 1980, he wrote The Politics of Cancer, and the only problem he had was wrong timing. That was the beginning of what turned out to be the Reagan Revolution. And Irving Selikoff, of course, really sets the standard for what good, solid research on asbestos dangers should look like, and spent years tirelessly gathering records, working with the unions, to document the damaging effect of low levels of asbestos and high levels of asbestos on the health of working men and women. And I was very grateful that I was able to work with them earlier in my career as well. But I think it's fair to say that they both suffered and were targets of attack. The situation for me now is actually a little bit different because I am working at a major medical center, the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. And I think the reason why I still have a job is because my boss is Ronald Herbermann. And Dr. Herbermann is the discoverer of natural killer cells. He wrote one of the most 100 influential scientific papers of all time. He himself has had some unusual personal experiences. He and his brother both developed the same rare cancer of the blood as middle-aged adults. There's no record of this cancer in their families, and yet they had some very interesting exposures. Each of them, as boys, ran in pesticide spray in the fields of Southern California, and they became doctors and researchers at a time when young men worked without any protective equipment, and they worked with some known carcinogens. So we don't know all of the things that contributed to the fact that both of these brothers, who are several years apart in age, came down with the same relatively rare cancer of the blood. But Dr. Herbermann now is the director of the Cancer Institute where I work, and he has said to me, get the science right, we need to have a solid program looking into this. And that is why we have the Center for Environmental Oncology now at the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute. We have a website, preventingcancernow.org. We have lots of materials available to your listeners about practical things they can do if they need to treat fleas in their pets or head lice in their children. There are ways to do this without poisoning them or putting their children at risk. And we've developed all of these materials at a major cancer center because growing numbers of doctors themselves, including my own boss now, understand that we have got to do a better job of reducing our use of things that put us at risk of developing cancer.
That was just so beautifully said. Thank you. And once again, that's the www.preventingcancernow.org site.
Thank you.
We're on the throes of a discussion here that has some element of controversy, which makes us very exciting. And so let me throw another little wrinkle into the discussion, and that's Bruce Ames, who I admire and respect very much as a biochemist, but has taken a very strong position that carcinogens represent but an insignificant load relative to the overall body burden of potential cancer-producing substances, and diet far outweighs the risk as it relates to environmental carcinogens. I know you have a different opinion. I'd like to have you share it with our listeners.
Well, first, let me say I share your view that Dr. Ames has done very important scientific work and that we're all grateful for. Unfortunately, he has taken a very strong view in areas that he is not an expert in, namely epidemiology, and has suggested that current cancer burdens today are chiefly due to nutrition and smoking and have nothing to do with the environment. His view is wrong, and the reason it's wrong is that we now have evidence from current scientific work that prenatal exposures to very low levels of things like diethyl stibestrol or bisphenol A, a plasticizer, can have profound effects on reproductive capacity, on the health of animals, and ultimately on whether or not they get cancer and the types of cancer that they do get. The most recent evidence of this is work on obesogens showing that the agouti mouse, when exposed to bisphenol A prenatally, can develop twice as the size and different color just if it's had one small exposure to bisphenol A at a critical period of organogenesis. That's extremely important work. It's parallel to work that was done by McLaughlin and others at the National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences, where they showed that exposure to diethylstibestrol, a synthetic estrogen, first synthesized, by the way, in the 1930s, early in gestation, can cause profound defects in offspring, male and female rats, and that those defects can be passed on to the third generation. And we now see an echo of that in human data generated by the National Cancer Institute that Dr. Ames may not be familiar with. The National Cancer Institute reported just this year that women whose mothers took diethylstibestrol when they were pregnant with them in the first trimester of that pregnancy have double the risk of breast cancer when they reach age 40. So we now have had 40 years of time for the natural experiments, unfortunately, to become evident that children are at risk from things that happen to them before they're born, and that it can take 40 or 50 years for those risks to become evident.
So this ties together very beautifully with the increasing understanding at the molecular biology, cellular biology level of epigenesis and how modulation of genomic tagging can then express different patterns, say tumor surveillance genes versus oncogenes, and how that can be passed on in the absence of mutations within the genome itself.
I think that's right. We know, for example, that if you look at identical twins and do chromosomal banding analysis, at age 3 they look pretty close to identical, monozygotic coming from one egg. But by the time they reach age 50, if you look at those same chromosomal bands for methylation patterns, they don't even necessarily look like they're related to one another if you look at paired twins at age 50 compared to age 3. And that's telling us something very simple and powerful. Genes give us the gun. The environment pulls the trigger, but the epigenetic effect is really fascinating, because that's where I think I'd like to know what you think about the evidence on breast cancer and hormone replacement therapy. Because some people say the downturn in breast cancer that we are seeing in older women, and it's a slight downturn, is due to the fact that fewer women are using synthetic hormone replacement therapy. If that's true, and I state if it's true, it's telling us that late-stage effects are working outside of genes, as in epigenetically, to accelerate cell growth and cause the expression of cancer, or in this case, turning off that cell growth so that even though you stop exposure late in the process, you get a downturn in cancer. But the whole field of nutritional work with cancer is full of examples where nutritional factors seem to be able to turn off cancer processes, even when they're established already.
Yes, and of course, you are one of the experts in this field. Again, I had mentioned in my introduction the article that you had authored in Scientific American, and that your co-author was the world-renowned steroid chemist, Leon Bradlow, and this work on estrogen metabolism has really created a whole another spin on how estrogen might be related to alterations in carcinogenicity.
Indeed, we know that, for example, alcohol is a cause of breast cancer, but most people don't realize that alcohol is highly estrogenic. That's why men who are alcoholics tend to have breasts, and alcohol stimulates the wrong hormone metabolism so that you get a higher amount of 16-alpha hydroxyestrone relative to 2-hydroxyestrone. And the more 16-alpha, the more bad estrogen, if you will, the greater the risk of breast cancer, particularly in postmenopausal women. So the question is, Dr. Bradlow and I have addressed in some of the work that we've done, and God bless him, he's still doing work today in his 80s, is whether there are synthetic materials, which we call xenoestrogens, that also can stimulate the production of the bad estrogen, 16-alpha hydroxyestrone. And we did a study that showed that a certain number of synthetic organic chemicals, including certain organochlorine pesticides, clearly increase the amount of 16-alpha hydroxyestrogen.
So if I could, and this is a big presumption, which actually is not a good thing to do, but I'm going to go into the unknown here and say, if I could try to summarize a platform upon which this discussion rests, it's this concept of how our physiology from the time of conception, maybe even preconceptual with the sperm and the egg, is influenced in its ultimate phenotypic expression by the environment through what we might call stress factors. And that could be radiation, infection, chemicals, all these things that you were describing, which really, as you point out in the book, goes back to starting with Walter Cannon with homeostasis and then Hans Selye with stress and then more recently Bruce McEwen with allostatic load. So this construct of the environment as a stress factor to physiology, it seems like a very interesting convergence of thinking of which medicine hasn't really adopted it.
I think it's really important. You have been leading a revolution, as I think you know. People are going to look back in 5 or 10 years and say, remember when we used to give people pills for ills without asking what was in their body and what the status of their nutrition was, their proteins, their enzymatic repair? We need to be smarter and look at where people live and where they work and what sorts of physiological and psychological stress they're under in order to understand how to help them heal. And I think we have generally not done that because the part of scientific medicine that has been carried to extreme is the notion that we can medicalize and use medication to treat most ills. And while we can do a lot of good things with medication, oftentimes medication is masking what the underlying cause of the problem is, as you have written and told people very well.
So if you were to leave a soundbite here at the end of what we could take hours and hours to discuss with your depth of knowledge, so if we were to try to get this into a soundbite, what message might you want to leave with physicians that are listening to this?
The dying words of Pasteur were, remember the host. Pasteur was the person, of course, credited with the germ theory of disease for understanding smallpox transmission. But as he lay dying, supposedly his last words were, remember the host. Look at where people work and live and what they eat and do, and understand that that plays an important role in their health and their illness, and understand, therefore, that the Chinese model of medicine, where we look at the whole person and we don't simply look at the manifestation of illness but ask how it evolved, is something we've got to take some good advice from. Looking at the whole conditions that contribute to the health and well-being of people becomes very important. Coming up now, we need to develop better methods for evaluating metals exposure, better methods for understanding historic experiences with nutrition, good and bad. And when we have those tools, we'll be more effective in helping people to stay well.
That's beautiful. So once again, I want to reemphasize on your mandatory reading list, those of you who are listening, should be The Secret History of the War on Cancer. I think that no matter how much you think you know about this topic, you will take the next level of understanding by reading the book and also checking in on the website, preventingcancernow.org. So I want to thank you, Dr. Davis. I know you've been very kind in giving us this time, and I think you've given a lot of people impetus to take the next step in their education.
Thank you, Dr. Bland. I appreciate your work.
So with all that we've talked about in this issue, you might ask the question, what's the takeaway? What phytochemicals might be very interesting and important in these chemo prevention processes? Well, with colon cancer, we've seen quite a bit of work being published on berry polyphenols, raspberry, blueberry. We recognize that fibers are very important for colon cancer as it relates to the butyrate formation that I was describing. We know that the hops humulus lupulus family of isoalpha acids have been found to be very chemo preventive in carcinogen-induced colon cancer in animal models. We know that various other fruits and vegetables, particularly the apple family, appear to have roles to play in colon cancer prevention. In the area of breast cancer, we've talked about those agents that help to improve estrogen detoxification. Those include things like the cruciferous vegetable glucosinolates that have indole-3-carbinol or dienoyl methane. We've looked at relationships, as you know, as it pertains to soy isoflavones and anthocyanidin-rich grape extracts as having chemo-preventive effects in breast cancer. And, of course, natural aromatase inhibitors that are being developed now to prevent hyperestrogenism. In prostate cancer, of course, you've got tomato-related products, which have a very strong chemo-preventive effect from statistical and animal studies, as well as soy products. We also talk about cruciferous vegetables, again, indole-3-carbinol, having a positive effect on prevention of prostate cancer due to the 3-4 estrogen quinones. And of course, there's a lot of medicinal herbs that have been found important in that of angiogenesis as well. And we saw a recent paper in the Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry talking about berry fruits as important as anti-angiogenic substances, including cranberries and raspberries and blueberries and red raspberries and strawberries. And so what we're really starting to witness is the fruits and berries and vegetable families having extraordinary chemopreventive protective effects across these stages of initiation, propagation, angiogenesis, and metastasis. So lots more to learn, but I hope we've given you some food for thought this month in Functional Medicine Update.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by Synthesis LLC by Dr. Jeffrey Bland. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.